Hey there, this is Sam Jones, and you're listening to another episode of Off Camera, here on the Wolf Pop Network, our new home. This episode of Off Camera is sponsored by Cards Against Humanity. And guess what? They asked us not to read an ad, so it's a win-win. Enjoy the show.
You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with actor Matt Damon. When a kid tells you he wants to be an actor and starts holding regular meetings in the high school cafeteria with his, quote, business partner, it's kind of cute. When they establish a joint bank account to fund New York audition trips and the occasional arcade game, well, call it naive, unless you're Matt Damon and said business partner is Ben Affleck. Then call it a no plan B, laser-like focus on a goal, one that spawned the Academy Award-winning script for Good Will Hunting. What started as an attempt to write themselves into acting jobs garnered Damon not only accolades, but also some early lessons about fame, career choices, and the industry he was determined to be a part of. It also enrolled him in a 20-year on-the-job masterclass with the best filmmakers of our generation, including Martin Scorsese, the Coen brothers, Steven Spielberg, Clint Eastwood, Steven Soderbergh, Francis Ford Coppola, and Gus Van Sant. He's used these opportunities, hard work, and his unflagging curiosity to develop a remarkably insightful approach to his craft. Along the way, he also developed an uncanny ability to disappear into any character and become someone believably different in every film. So what could possibly be next? Damon tells off camera why, no matter what it is, it will be something that he absolutely loves. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Go.
Hi, Matt. How you doing?
Good, man. How you doing?
Good. It's taken a while to get you here, and I appreciate you coming, squeezing it in between school drop-offs and pickups.
Yeah, no, that was. I'm sorry I didn't come earlier. I was in a mountain biking accident.
Yes, you were. Yes, you were.
I kind of threw you for a loop there a couple months ago.
So you and I met a long time ago, I think in the late 90s, at a photo shoot that we did for... I think Premiere Magazine.
Premiere Magazine, yeah.
And we went out and had like this Huck Finn day. There was a lake. We jumped a train. We built a raft. We swam in a creek. And I remember thinking, you know, I was so impressed with your commitment to the photo shoot. And I was like, God, if he only knew what most actors are willing to do at a photo shoot. I mean, we had you covered with mud at one point and hoisted in the air by a bunch of dudes playing mud football.
But that was my favorite. Because, you know, that was right probably within a year and a half of Good Will Hunting. And so my life had just really changed. And what always struck me about that was that group of guys that, you know, were covered in mud like we were playing mud football. And they lifted me up on their shoulders and you were taking pictures. And I remember thinking it was kind of like the peak of the surreality because they had to hire fake friends. I remember just thinking, this is fucking crazy. Like, what is going on with my life? Like, they've literally hired extras to play my friends and pretend to have a good time with me.
That's right.
Like, you know, and I just, in trying to recalibrate your whole life when you become famous, like, that was a real moment for me because it was like, you know, it took a couple years to try to find my feet again after Good Will Hunting. It was one of those weird things where I had... three movies in the can, and it was The Rainmaker that Coppola had directed, Good Will Hunting, which Ben and I had written, and which Gus Van Sant had directed, and then Saving Private Ryan, which obviously Steven Spielberg directed. And they all came out within 7-8 months of each other. And so it was like this, everything just changed. And I think I hid... My work really saved me because I was able to still be an actor. I did nothing but work for probably, I mean, I'm really taking my first break now in like 15 years, and which was by design because I love working. But work really saved me because I got to be an actor. Like movie crews don't care about you know, any of the, this nonsense. They just want to work. And so I got to, work kind of shielded me from all that bullshit.
Well, I took away from that shoot that, that you shielded yourself with that on purpose. Like even when our raft was sinking and we had a prop guy there who was going to fix it, you're like, no, no, give me the hammer. And you're out there trying to hammer the thing back together. And it struck me as like, you know, you're holding on to your normalcy as much as you could. And it seems like you're still that. That's still a big thing for you.
Yeah, I mean, it was like the experience of becoming famous is what's the most bizarre about it is that you know intellectually that the world is exactly the same as it was yesterday, because it is. The same things that matter, you know, still matter.
Sure.
Except your subjective reality is altered forever because everybody treats you differently. So the world, you know, the world is the same, but your world is absolutely different and never will be the same again. And that's the real mindfuck of it. And so, and that's why I say surreal. It is a just absolutely surreal experience. And I'd always heard people say, well, you can't prepare for it. You can't, it just is something that you just have to kind of deal with. And everybody just deals with it with whatever tools they have, whatever their foundation is. And you know, I was very lucky to have the family that I had and the people around me that I had who just never drank the Kool-Aid. And because you have to be a little more vigilant about keeping the dynamic, the kind of the power balance in all of your primary relationships exactly the same. Because the world is trying to tell you that you should have more power in those, even in those primary relationships. And of course you can't, or else you destroy those relationships. They have to remain the same. I mean, it's really, I really think about it a lot with my wife and my kids. I mean, that's, you know, that's where it matters the most.
Sure. Do you even remember feeling anonymous? Like, do you remember what that felt like? Or was it so long ago at this point?
No, I remember it really well. I remember those years of not... It was incredibly frustrating. Being an actor, a struggling actor, it really sucks. And it's because you're at this age when you're, you know, in your, say, early 20s, you have all of this creative energy. And you know, Ben and I realized this is never going to happen for us if we sit and wait for it. I remember a big movie was Primal Fear. You remember that movie?
Yes, I do, with Ed Norton.
So that was a great example, and that was kind of a, you know, a moment for me when I realized, okay, there's this great role, and for some odd reason, no actor who is known wants to play it, right? So right there, that's a rarity, that a really good role is going to escape the clutches of the people who are already established. But once it does, then it gets kicked down to the rest of us, and there are thousands of us, right? Of those thousands, how much are, like, really, like, ballers, you know what I mean? I don't know. I mean, what is that real number, 100? But I remember I hired a dialect coach with money I did not have to prepare for that audition, because I knew that whoever took this role, I mean, it was gonna break somebody. And
how did you know that?
It was such a good role in a script that you could just see the movie was gonna work and the role could really work. And it was a chance to kind of make a splash. It's very hard to kind of make a splash as an unknown actor, and it was a lead in a big movie basically, and Edward Norton beat out everybody for the part. Deservedly so. He was great. But I remember thinking, when is the next one of these going to come around?
Right.
You know, how long is it going to be? And that's when Ben and I, you know, around that time, we were writing Good Will Hunting for the express reason. We were just literally trying to write ourselves jobs. We had no designs to be kind of screenwriters. We had no... that wasn't a part of who we thought we were or what our identity was. We just wanted to work. We had all of this energy and nowhere to put it. And that's why you see a lot of people go off into drugs or off into, you know, it's like this frustration and they have nowhere to put it and they go out at night and, you know, whereas we were hyper-focused and like, well, what can we be doing? We were ambitious in the right way in that we weren't screwing anybody over for our, but we were really working hard on how to make this dream that we both had of being working actors, how to really make it happen.
I think of Courage Under Fire, where you were, it seemingly from reading about how you lost all the weight and everything, you were desperate to sink your teeth into a role and make people see that you were a serious baller, as you say.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, and also, look, it felt great. The reality was to play that role, I you know, again, it was a much smaller role than Primal Fear. It was probably number 5 on the call sheet. You know, and I really had 3 scenes post, you know, when the guy's a heroin addict and he's, you know, when I lose all the weight, it was just for 3 scenes. It was like, it was two kind of big scenes and one little one. So it was 2 days of work,
right?
Literally 2 days of work. And then it was a whole bunch of work when I put the weight back on, when it was like the flashback stuff. God. But it actually felt really good. It felt like I was being productive. Every time I went for a run, as much as a pain in the ass it was, it felt like, all right, I'm working. You know what I mean? And
right.
That all of this energy that I have, that I've been dying to pour into something, I'm now able to pour into this.
Well, and it says something about your mindset of, you know, if I get an opportunity, there is no way I'm not going to make it happen for me, right? Did that come? I mean, were you always that kid?
Yeah, I think, but I became, yes, but more so like when confronted with the reality of trying to make it in Hollywood, you know, it's just a really tough racket. And I know it happens for some people and it can be easy. I mean, look, when Ben and I, when Good Will Hunting came out, everybody said we were overnight successes, which for us, we were like, I'd been in the union for 10 years, 11 years by the time that thing came out and had been slugging it out. And Ben got in the union when I think he was 8. So, you know, I think Ben got his pension. He qualified for his pension like 6 or 7 years ago.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. So our kind of ascension felt like it was overnight to people. But obviously, you know, it wasn't.
You don't come from an acting family.
No.
Was there a performance or a film or some event that happened that made you go, that's what I want to do?
Well, I always loved movies, but then I had a great teacher in high school. And I felt like I wanted to be an actor, but I went to high school 13 years old as a freshman and knew that I was going to take classes with this guy. He was kind of very well known in my town, and he really was a guy named Jerry Specka, and he really was just a huge part of why Ben and I pursued it with such discipline and always took our work so seriously. He was very, very, he was a great teacher in that way. He taught even kids who didn't go into drama, you know, professionally. But just took his classes, got something about a work ethic from him, because he always he forced you to take your work so seriously, and those were great lessons to have at a really young age.
That's pretty amazing to be that young and know that.
It was very lucky. I mean, I always felt lucky. I remember going to college and feeling sorry for all of my friends because they, you know, we got to the end of college and they didn't know what to do, and which, I mean, I'm sure most people don't know what they're going to do when they're 21, you know.
Right.
But I knew when I was 13, basically. Ben and I talked about it recently because, you know, we were young and we were going to New York together when he was 14 and I was 16, and we were auditioning for stuff, you know, going to New York by ourselves. We had these whole professional, we had these careers, you know. They weren't going anywhere really, but we'd go, we'd audition, we'd get called back, you know. And I think about, wow, you know, we were really, really young. And I think we fed on each other's enthusiasm. I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't met Ben, you know.
Wow.
My senior year in high school, we used to have what we called business lunches. There was no business to discuss. But we just were, it was kind of our way to mark every day that, like, you know, we got our eye on the ball here. And we would go sit in the smaller of the 2 cafeterias called the media cafeteria at Cambridge Orange and Latin, and we go sit there and just like, so what business, you know, like there was nothing to talk about, but we were obsessed with it. We were really, which is strange when we think of, because we felt fully developed, like, but I look at pictures of us then, or you know, or I talk to, I mean, my oldest is 15, and I go, you know, would I let this kid get on a bus and go to New York by herself and, you know, audition for stuff. And this was New York in the 80s. I mean, it wasn't, right. It's a lot nicer now, you know.
Well, your mom, did she support, like, the idea of a movie career or that kind of thing as much? Or did she like it when it was contained within the confines of Cambridge?
They did not want me to do it. Neither my dad nor my mom wanted me to do it professionally.
Why is that?
Because they wanted me to go to college. They wanted me to finish. They were afraid I was going to get a job and it was going to derail my life. Like, I was so young and to me, I was, well, you know, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And when you're 16, you know, I felt like I was 60 and, you know, well, let's go. I gotta work. And they really wanted me to get through college and, you know, at least have that. You know, people would say, well, so you have something to fall back on. I knew I was never falling back on anything, that I was going to do this no matter what. But I did also understand the value of getting a liberal arts education and, you know, and not just kind of striking out on my own.
So it never crossed your mind, like, if I do this for 6, 7, 8 years and nothing happens,
no.
Here's what I'll... You never had a plan B.
No, there was no plan B. There was no plan B. And I always heard, there was an actor I heard say years ago, like in the 80s actually, whenever somebody asked me if I should do this, I tell them no. Because I figure if, and I've always followed that advice, because if you can dissuade somebody from doing it in one conversation, because everybody told me no. Everybody told me it wasn't going to work. Everybody said, you know, you'll never make it. The odds are so small. You know, you have to not care about that stuff.
Right.
You know, and if you do, then you really should do something else because you won't make it. It's too hard a gig.
Did it ever come to the point where you didn't feel supported by your parents or did they always sort of relent and let you, like, did you have to sneak to New York or did
No,
they
were, they, what was great about them is they didn't stop me, but they voiced their disapproval in the sense that they said, listen, we love that you want to be an actor and we love that you take it this seriously and that it gives you this kind of focus, but why don't you just stay here and do theater? And, you know, we had this great high school theater program and, you know, and then you go to college and you can do theater in college and do as much of it as you want. And then, you know, New York's going to be there when you're done. But I was just so jonesing to do it. You know, and the first job I got was a real job besides commercials and things like that, local radio commercials and things that kind of gave us the money. Ben and I had a joint bank account. We'd go to New York. And if you made money acting, you went into the account and the account was only to be used if you were going to New York for an audition, or if we took $10 out to like play video games at the arcade. And I got a line in the movie Mystic Pizza, and the line was, "Mom, do you want my green stuff?" And literally, but it was a scene that was a big dinner table scene. Julia Roberts, it was like a big movie for her, and it was this whole dinner table scene. And so it took us 3 nights to shoot, and down in Mystic, Connecticut. And I was a minor, so my mother had to come with me. And you know, we shot from 5 to 5 every night, and I just remember being so in love with the process of film. I was like, this is the greatest. It was the best time I'd ever had in my life, and it was, you know, I was like, this is amazing. I want this to never, ever, ever stop. Like, I loved it.
And was Julia Roberts at that point? Did you know her?
No, she was just no.
That was her first.
That was her big thing for her, and she was just the star of this little movie that was, you know, nobody knew it was going to be as successful as it was, and then that she was going to become the biggest, you know, the biggest actress in the world.
Now, did she seem like an adult to you, and you were a kid?
Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
And it's funny because she's probably 2 years older than me, you know, but at the time, like, she was an adult. She was living in New York. She was, you know, and I was a high school kid, you know, so
right.
So it was a big 2 years then, you know, now not at all.
Now, do you remember specifically the experience the first time you saw yourself on screen?
Yeah, I mean, I remember going to see the movie and I remember it the scene passes pretty quickly, you know, I remember that I ad-libbed the line when the guy who played my brother, Adam Stork, he pulls the tablecloth off the table at the end of the scene. And I said, shit, man, when he did that. And it made it into the movie. And my family was all like, I remember my aunts and uncles like, you know, because it was more than the one line that I'd said that I had. So they were like, you know, I ad-libbed a line.
Now, I find it interesting that, you know, first off, that you say your writing of Good Will Hunting was a means to give yourself a job. But I also wonder about the sort of good fallout from that. And I wonder if it changed the conversation in terms of going into audition or to try to get roles in the future, being a writer, if that sort of changed the conversation for you about the job and put you in a different position than other actors.
Yeah, and in a couple ways. One was that from the moment Good Will Hunting came out, I think directors looked at me differently in the sense that, you know, there's always kind of a creative team, you know, like a little group that's, you know, brain trust that's
sure.
making a movie. And the director is the boss, you know, it's a dictatorship, you know, it's a benevolent dictatorship. And it has to be for it to work. There has to be one person making all the decisions. But, you know, invited into that kind of group are the other people that the director leans on and trusts. And it's really everyone's job to throw ideas at the director, and then the director is the arbiter of taste and the final judge about what's going to happen and what's not. But being seen as a writer allowed me to be taken into that group. So, you know, I went and did The Talented Mr. Ripley right after, and Anthony Minghella, who directed it, was really solicitous of my opinions and ideas and. You know, that movie, and I love that movie, is very much his film. I mean, he is the director of the movie. But it felt to me like a partnership. And all of these experiences that I've had subsequently really felt like partnerships. Now, granted, as the actor, you're the junior partner, right? Because it's a director's medium. But you can have a huge impact, you know, depending on how you and the director, you know, how your tastes are aligned, you can have a huge impact on, you know, the movies that you're making.
Yeah, you were still very young in Talented Mr. Ripley, and you look at that performance and you look very young, and you know, Anthony Minghella is not a young guy at the point he's making the film, and you're
my age. I realized recently, I think
you're
he was
kidding.
Yeah, I'm 43, and I think he was 43 or 44, which seems really young to me now, and I go, shit, because Anthony seems so old and like this wizened, you know, and
right.
But he's no, he's a middle-aged guy.
But that had to feel interesting to be brought into those conversations.
No, it was amazing.
Did it open up sort of the I don't know, the mechanics behind these relationships and how things work?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. That and the other thing I just that writing did was it took that insecurity away that it was all going to go away because Ben and I had written ourselves out of, you know, onto the scene, basically, out of total obscurity, right? Like, you can't get any lower than we were when we wrote that thing. And suddenly we had careers. And so even when Ben, those years where the films weren't working and there was this whole misconception of who he was versus who I knew he actually was, you know, but his image was a very, like, a good distance away from who he really was. He, with Gone Baby Gone and then The Town, he like wrote himself back into.
Same thing.
Yeah, it's the
I
same
never
thing.
Thought
so
of it that
so he's
way.
So he did it twice basically with Good Will Hunting and then kind of resurrected a career that wasn't in a good place all the way to, you know, getting Best Picture.
No, that's really interesting. And it also makes me question what you learned about being an actor from writing something and then every day going and filming it, seeing what works, going back the next day. I'm sure it was a very, you know, write, rewrite, watch. What did it teach you about being an actor?
I think the last the last 15 years really have, I think when I started out, I had that very kind of method immersion, you know, it's all about acting, it's all about, you know, don't mess with my process. I remember when I was doing Saving Private Ryan, there was a scene, and I was on set, and it was a scene between a couple other guys, and Spielberg moved on, And he was marching off to the next kind of little place he was going to shoot. And I said, Steven, you know, don't you think we should have done a couple more takes of that thing, you know, because it hadn't been great. He turned on a dime and he said, I could spend another hour on that scene and perhaps make it 10% better, or I can go do another great shot. I'm going to do the shot. And I remember at the time feeling like, well, that's, I'm mildly offended by that, you know. And I think where I am now is exactly where he was then. And I think that's right, that it's not, it's, I've come to see it as a magic trick, right, that you're, that these 100 people have come together to try to make work. And it's not all about any one person's thing. It's really about the director and how can you support, yeah, the magician, right? And where so I think my process went from being very selfish to kind of like, because I remember Steven saying once, Spielberg saying once, somebody said, well, I think my character should be, and he goes, you can do whatever you want, but do it over there, because that's where the movie's going to be. Like, you know, he didn't indulge that stuff. It was right. Like, and I think the great challenge and the fun for me is to try to look at the design of the movie and try to make the performance work within the design rather than try to make the whole thing come to me. You know what I mean? And that's really the craft, right? Like the Liberace movie, there's a shot of me in the foreground and Michael in the background, and he's talking, and I'm sitting there like drinking wine and smoking a cigarette, and he comes over, and we've been kind of fighting, and then I reveal that my mother's died, right? My foster. And it's all one shot. And it's like, okay, so how the fuck am I going to break down in this scene at minute two of a shot that I know is hinging on performance, but it's also like beautifully designed, and you know what I mean? So it's like, yeah. That to me is the trick. That's the tech. That's where your technique comes in.
You'll hear more of this off-camera conversation after a short break.
Hey, it's Sam Jones here. And if you're enjoying this show, why not head over to wolfpop.com to explore some more shows on the Wolfpop Network, after this one's done, of course. Wolfpop has a new show from the founder of Badass Digest, Devin Faraci, and chief film critic of the LA Weekly, Amy Nicholson, called The Canon. If you like important movies and you'd like some healthy, heated discussion, then you'll love The Canon. Every week, Amy and Devin battle to figure out whether or not a great film is worthy of that coveted spot in the canon. The final choice is left to you, the listeners, who vote to decide if the film makes the cut. A brand new episode is available for download today at wolfpop.com.
And now, back to the conversation.
There's also this magic that happens on a film where, you know, you have one idea of the film in your mind when you're writing it. You probably have another idea when you're directing it or acting in it, and a third when you're editing it. And then when an audience sees it, they pick up on something that managed to escape everybody, mm-hmm. but somehow it stayed in. Like, did you find that with Good Will Hunting, that movies have a opportunity to surprise even the people that are making them?
I think the biggest surprise about Good Will Hunting for us was Ben and I, you know, because we wrote it over the course of like 5 years, and we had been playing all of the parts back and forth to each other, like bouncing ideas off each other. When it came time to finally do the movie, I don't think either of us really understood how much my character was the lead. You know, we always saw it as a two-hander. We'd written the Robin Williams part. Literally, we called it our Harvey Keitel role because we had heard in Reservoir Dogs, the movie got made because Harvey's name was worth money. And so once they got Harvey Keitel, the movie got, you know, the movie had a budget.
Sure.
And so we said, we need a Harvey Keitel role here. We were really interested in writing a story about the four guys in South Boston. That to us was interesting. But we wrote a Harvey Keitel role. To try to snag, you know, a big actor. And so when the movie came out, I think there was this perception that because my part was bigger, and also because I played a guy who was a genius, that I actually must have done more of the work in writing the script. But it was incredibly unfair to Ben. And also, right after the movie came out, that summer, the two biggest movies of the summer were Saving Private Ryan and Armageddon. And Armageddon, which Ben starred in, seemed to be like this kind of fluffy popcorn, you know, movie. And Saving Private Ryan was a very serious World War II movie. And so again, I got the patina of seriousness, and Ben got the he's a pretty movie star thing. And when the reality was, like, I would have taken Armageddon, Ben would have taken Private Ryan. Like, we had movies in the can, but nothing had come out. We were looking for jobs. And I remember being in the room with Harvey Weinstein when Ben was up for Armageddon, and he said, "Could you please call the director and or the studio and just put in a good word for me?" Because it was a big job. And I remember lobbying for Ben too, like, "Come on, Harvey, you know, please," which he did. Harvey called Michael Bay and said, "You know, this kid's great," you know. And so it was odd to get attributed this, you know what I mean? Like, it got attributed to him as, oh, he wants to make kind of a more superficial type of movie, and Matt wants to make more serious movies.
Well, they mistook you also for the kid. Like,
and they mistook
me.
They
took the roles.
They took the roles, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and there was a really mean kind of Saturday Night Live skit. I remember feeling really bad about it. I saw it, and I couldn't believe it. It was like the two of us were writing Good Will Hunting, and Ben was like a Neanderthal. And he was like, he literally was like, you know, it was like Phil Hartman's Frankenstein or whatever. It's like, ugh. And he was like sitting there like doing hammer curls. And I was writing the entire thing. And like that was the kind of the, you know, and what I think was painful for Ben. I mean, it must have been.
I'm
we never
sure.
really talked about it. But especially after all of that work and all of that, you know, we could not have done that without each other, you know? And it was the end. It was this culmination of this kind of dream, this kind of journey that we'd kind of launched, you know, in 1986, you know? And suddenly it was 1998 and, you know, we had Academy Awards for this thing and it was, but for some reason there was a perception that...
Well, it's interesting. Even thinking back about the film, there's such a strong father-son story happening between Robin Williams and you that it doesn't feel like a two-hander.
No. No, that's right. And on paper, what was interesting on paper was Ben had these long monologues, right? So he actually, in the final draft that we, in their shooting draft, Ben had more lines than me in Good Will Hunting.
Interesting.
We really wanted him to be this guy who was the life of the party, and every time the four guys were together, Will was much quieter. And Chucky, Ben's character, was kind of holding court, and he was always holding court, and he was like this kind of Mercutio. He just was like, and everybody loved him, and he was the life of the party. And two of those, kind of two of his big scenes got cut out for length.
It also tells you, like, maybe it was also a lesson of it's not about how many lines you have or necessarily. But
no, it's about the movie and where is the movie going. And like the credit sequence was me doing math, you know, and which made into the minute that, you know, Gus shot some stuff kind of towards the end. He's like, "Let's just get you doing equations. Oh, I can use it somewhere." It turned out to be the credit sequence. So you're walking into the movie and they're saying, "Okay, this is the movie. This is the story."
And that's the guy.
And that's the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was surprising.
Once public perception is sort of cemented.
Yeah, it's going back to your point of what you said before. Like, it's that you only get one chance to make a first impression.
Right.
Like, you can fail in private as much as you want, but once, like, this is it, and then people go, okay, that's who you guys are, and they make that kind of snap judgment. I think the perception of him now is much more in line with who he actually
sure.
is, you know.
It took a long time.
But it took a long time. It took a long time, and he really had to earn that, I mean, from, say, 2006 to now, I mean, he's been making fantastic choices and working really, really hard. I mean, he's written however many scripts he's written. He's directed three movies. He's starred in, you know, in, say, The Town. He gives a great performance in that movie, but he was the only guy who would give himself a role like that at the time.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And he's been the best in the movies that he's directed himself in because he trusts the director. It's true, you know, and now he's like coming to a place where, which is exciting, where directors, you know, the A-list directors want to work with him. I mean, he's just finishing up with David Fincher now.
And yeah.
So not only is he going to, like, he's going to learn even more about directing, right, because he just sits there and talks cameras with Fincher all day long, but he's got a director who he can lean on and who can actually, you know, because he's been great in movies, But like a movie like Changing Lanes, which Roger Michel directed, and he's a great director. You know, it's a director's medium. Like I said at the beginning, it really is. if you align yourself with those guys, they will protect you and they'll protect your performance. And you know, and if you, and if they don't know what they're doing, and he, Ben's kind of Achilles heel has always been that he's an optimist. And I've always said it about him, like when we were kids, we'd go to a movie and with all of our friends and we'd walk out and we'd be in the parking lot and everybody would go, that sucked. And he goes, yeah, but you know what would have made it great? And he would give like the five changes he would have made on the fly. And we'd all go, well, yeah, I mean, that would have been great. They should have done that. Like he could script doctor when he was 16 years old. And so he would get into these situations. He took a lot of jobs that I passed on. You know, a couple of them, and we would argue about the merits of this or that movie. I said, "Why are you doing this, man? You can see that it doesn't work." He goes, "Yeah, but here's what we could do to fix it." The problem was he wasn't the director,
right?
And
like, he optimistically thought,
"Well, obviously, I'm just going to explain this reasonably to this guy, and they're going to have to agree because it's evident, but you know, that it's not working on the page." And that's why the movies that have worked have been the ones that he's. Either where he's had a great director or where he's been the director, because as a good soldier will, he would fall into line at the end. You know, he would argue his point but you know, you have to acquiesce at the end. It's the director's movie,
right?
But if the director isn't as good as you, then you're fucked.
Well, I'm sure it's an easy trap to fall into, especially at your guys' level, where so much of getting the movie made depends on your involvement, and so much of the responsibility must feel like it falls on your shoulders as well. I mean,
that's why I've worked with Steven Soderbergh 7 times, you know, because like you find people, or Paul Greengrass or Gus or these guys that whose taste you love and who are just great. Yeah, they're great directors. It's just you don't. they're very clear about what they're making. You know, it's again, it feels more like a partnership in that, and you are the junior partner, but you're there. You're part of the. I remember when we did Contagion, my favorite scene in the movie was there's a scene where Gwyneth Paltrow plays my wife, and, mm-hmm. and a doctor comes in an ER and says that she's dead, basically. And this happens on like page 6 or 7. And so we get to work, and I'm going, and you know, or a week before, Steven says, "Do you have any, you know, kind of reservations about this?" And I said, "Yeah, the one scene I'm worried about is this scene in the ER, because, you know, fuck. I mean, I've seen it. The best I've ever seen it done is Ben Affleck in Jersey Girl, actually. Kevin Smith did it in one shot, and he finds out that Jennifer Lopez dies. This was in the rough cut. I assume it's in the final film. And it is, he falls to pieces. I mean, it's in a great scene. I mean, it's one shot, and the camera's just pulling away as you see this guy, his wife has died in childbirth, and it's like, you know, the love of his life, and it's devastating. And so I'm like, well, you know, so I've seen that, so we ain't doing that, right?
Right.
We don't just ape that. And I go, well, I mean, do we do? And Steven goes, "The Lean," you know, which is the other thing you've seen, shot down the hallway. You know, you don't hear the words. The doctor comes up, the guy leans against the wall, and you know, and it's like,
right. The lean.
You know, the lean. And I'm like, I'm not saying do the fucking lean, but I go, but we have a serious structural problem. This is page 6. We don't know me. We don't know Gwyneth's character. We're not invested in the relationship. And you want to get the movie going. It's Contagion. It's about the virus is loose. It's not a movie about like these people. So we go to work, and Scott Burns has written a good scene. It's a very good scene, actually. And, but we have the real guy there from the ER, and we said, "Well, how does this go?" And he goes, "Is this an unexpected death?" And we said, "Absolutely." And he goes, "Okay. Well, I've had this conversation hundreds of times, and about half the time, it's the opposite of that. And what happens is actually, I come out and I'm with I have a social worker with me, right? So, you know, in the scene, there's this social worker who comes out with him, and he says, you know, I'm sorry, and Scott had written, I'm sorry to tell you that, you know, your wife has passed away. He'd basically got the right idea. But what this doctor pointed out is that their language is much more brutal. It's much more harsh because you're trying to get through to the person this concept that's so huge and kind of they're not going to be able to wrap their brain around, that you say, unfortunately, her heart did stop and she did die. And it's just this lethal, like, and it's a script. Like, it's a script that they go on. Then the guy says, okay, and he's listening. He goes, okay, can I go talk to her? Because it literally is too big a concept for him to.
It doesn't register. I remember that.
Yeah. He walked us through what his script was, and, you know, the social worker goes to talk to the kid, like this whole kind of thing. And Scott wrote it up, and it was just Scott and Steven and me. And we shot the scene, and it was like, you know, less than an hour, we were done. And it's great. And it's great because you look at it and you go, oh, God. It's like you recognize, you go, oh, my God, that must be true. You can feel it. You know what I mean? You can. But it achieved what we wanted it to achieve, which is that the scene kind of, it's over with, so we can get on with Contagion. It's really eerie and you've never seen it before. And so that's what it's like to work with a great director. You know, you're honest about what you're worried about. They're honest about, you know, that we're going to solve it. Don't worry. And
right.
You solve it.
Right. Because take the case of a first time director. If they have the sort of foresight to even say any issues that you have, and you say, I have a problem, they may not have the ability or the confidence to be able to say, yeah, let's figure that out. Or if you heard that from a first timer, you'd be like, what do you mean, yeah, let's figure it out?
Right. Well, also they'll say, like, let's just do it once this way, and then we'll try some, you know, which is, every actor knows, it's total bullshit. Like, don't shine me on. Like, if you're going to ask me the question, then you got to deal with the answer. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Don't say, let's do it once the way that I'm telling you I don't get it. You know what I mean? Like, because it's all about, like, you know, if you understand what's going on for the character, then you should be able to do it. But if you literally don't, you go, I don't understand why they say that at that point. Like, what is it? You know what I mean? And oftentimes when a script isn't quite there, you'll get situations like that, and if a director's not experienced, they'll go, well, let's just try it the way it's written once, and then you're going to have a scene with an actor that's uninvested. It doesn't work, and it will never work, you know. And so until you guys figure out what the fuck you're doing, you know, then you can do it, but you know, it won't. There's no magic fairy dust that gets sprinkled on in post production that's going to make something work that doesn't work.
Sure.
When you're just doing it.
I mean, that right. Certainly opens up some sort of you know, a lens onto your process too, because it tells me that you have to know all the information around the lines.
Yeah, it's like a practical matter. You know what I mean? It's like, again, like going back to the magic trick analogy. It's like we all have to know what we're doing because we have to do it together. You know, don't worry about, you know, the emotion part, like my dark secrets or whatever I need to get where I go. I'm a professional actor and I'll do that. But like we have to know what we're doing, all of us, and the great directors I've found are the most practical people,
right.
You know. And I don't know if that's why they're the great directors, but it seems to be like they're about kind of rolling their sleeves up and kind of, you know, let's take the engine apart and look at it and go like, okay, well, what helps us? What's working? What's not? And it's Steven calls it, Soderbergh calls it like opening the kimono. You know, and he wants his whole crew to have the most information that they can have. Like when we did Behind the Candelabra, it was what was incredible about it was every day we'd go, we'd shoot 7 pages probably, which is just fun. So it was fun to do all these big scenes, but and long scenes. You know, I'd go home, I'd eat, I'd be home in time for dinner. I'd put the kids in the bath, I'd read them a story, I'd put them to bed. I'd come downstairs to eat with my wife, and by the time I'd come downstairs, I'd have an email that says, there's something waiting for you on the Pix website. I would take my iPad, I'd go onto the Pix website and log in and would see the scene that we shot that day cut together. So in the time that it had taken me to eat dinner and put the kids down, or, you know, get them to bed, Steven had gone home. He'd cut everything we'd shot that day because he's shooting on a Red, so it's all digital. So he cuts that all together and sends it out, not just to me, but to Michael and to the other actors and to all of his department heads. So, you know, Ellen Mirajnik, the wardrobe supervisor, Howard Cummings, like, you know, every single person was walking around with iPads with the movie out of order on their iPad. So if you needed to refer to something, You know, oh, that scene we did 3 weeks ago. Okay, he's going out on the shot of Michael's face, and now he's going to start with this big wide. Like, he wanted every, it was more information than I'd ever had as an actor. And, like, you can't fuck that up as an actor. Like, the one excuse you ever have as an actor, if your performance doesn't work, is you say, I didn't know what movie I was in. That's your only excuse. Like, right. I thought we were doing something totally different. But with that, like, you literally have no excuse. If you mess that up, you're a bad actor.
Well, it throws out the whole idea of, oh, the actor that doesn't want to watch dailies or... it kind of...
And when I started my career, I wouldn't watch anything. And I had this... And
how do you justify both those decisions now?
I think once you've seen yourself a lot, you get past the stupid vanity stuff that I think can... fuck you up at the beginning.
Okay.
You know?
So in the, when you were young, you had to be able to not really know what was going on to lose yourself in a part.
Yeah. I think.
And now you know how to do it.
Yeah, and you know, and then I hear, like, you know, De Niro was always famous for watching dailies religiously. He would go and if you look at that level of detail in those performances, you know, through the 70s and 80s, like, you know, and what he was doing, like, it makes sense. That's why, again, this magic trick thing, because it's like, you have to be able to, like, look at it. And you know, I assume a magician videotapes themselves to make sure that the trick is,
sure,
you know, is working. You have to know what you're doing. And I think I did used to have that kind of feeling, like, well, I'll just be totally invested and I'll just do it and then it's going to come out. So I think when I was younger, I believed, like, you know, I have to go home and be miserable if I'm miserable in the scene. And, you know, if it's like... You know, when you're doing, so I use the example of a play because, like, when you step on stage, you don't have a fucking choice. It doesn't matter what you feel. Like,
right.
These people paid money, and, you know, you're doing this play, you know, and you got to be Willie Loman, you better do it. And, you know, there's no, like, can we hold for a second and give me some time for my process? Like,
right.
And that's a great thing about doing plays and why actors who come from the theater have such fantastic technique because, like, no matter what is going on, they have to deliver at that moment. You know what I mean? And you know, in movies, we can get a little lazier because we can say, can I just have 5 minutes to go, you know, get myself prepared? But there's something great about the inevitability of the theater, which is just you go now. You know, like you know, we're in it. The lights are coming up. No choice. And oftentimes that is really all you need, you know, is the gun to your head.
So you mentioned technique, and I read a New York Times review of you from a long time ago where it basically was saying how you are able to disappear into your roles, and I'm sure that's a high compliment for an actor. And I put you in a class with actors like, you know, like Tom Hanks, where it is a magic trick. You're such a relatable person that... What all the work and the technique and the, even when you talk about it and say, I'm a professional actor, I know what I'm doing, it sounds a little unbelievable to me because it just seems like you're just being completely natural and your work disappears into your character.
Thanks.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's different than creating a persona or creating a, you know, I think different actors find themselves able to do different things and have different skill sets. And I wondered if you at some point said, oh, I know my skill set. I know what it is I do. And at that point, were you able to focus your work even more?
Right. It just depends. It kind of depends on the role. You know what I mean? Like when you're the lead of the movie, you're kind of supposed to be a cipher a little bit. You it's like a novel. You want people to be able to read into it. You know, like Gene Hackman was always my guy. I mean, I just... thought he was always so brilliant and believable and real and you know, there's some people just overact, you know what I mean, and a lot of that shit gets rewarded you know, with awards and stuff, and so I think people get the idea that's, I mean, I always look at people and go, like, do I believe, have I ever had an interaction like that with a human being? Is that human behavior? You know what I mean? Or is it just something that's kind of, you know, just overacting, basically? So So yeah, I mean, but there are different parts required. Like, I've always felt like a character actor. Like, the more, you know, something like True Grit or something, like, that's a lot of fun. Like, I'm not carrying any of that water of being the lead of the movie. You know, you can be more colorful, believable, but colorful.
Well, I wanted to ask you about LaBeouf, because I feel like that character didn't have any precedent or any, you know, it didn't come from any amalgamation of people we've seen in the Old West before. Like, it seems like whatever the beginnings of LaBeouf were, they were completely original. And I wondered, like, it brings up for me, how do you do that? How do you take some lines in a role and go, okay, now I'm gonna build an original character?
It was really well written. It was really well written, and Joel and Ethan knew exactly what they wanted to do and were very clear with, like, what... I mean, the guy is a total jackass, and it was just, you know... I laughed every day on that movie and with those guys. Like, you know, there's the magic trick portion, which you go, okay, well, it's West Texas, so I'm gonna just, you know, I've lived down there and I know, you know, and so I use Tommy Lee as a role model, just because Tommy Lee is, I know Tommy Lee Jones, he directed me in something 20 years ago, and he was a perfect model for the character in the sense that Tommy Lee is brilliant, and he can hold court on anything. And he's one of the most interesting guys to listen to on any subject. He's very, very, very erudite, you know, interesting guy, like, to talk to. And so I wanted the presentation of Tommy Lee Jones, absent the substance, right? And those guys had worked extensively with Tommy Lee, so they were like, okay, yeah, that's great. You know, and then he gets his tongue bitten off, and, you know, so I was in the hair and makeup trailer one day on another movie thinking about True Grit, and I just grabbed a hair tie and wrapped it around my tongue, around the part where they said he had bit, and tried to talk, and it was just, and I was crying, I was laughing so hard, I was like, this is really going to work. And so that was... You know, and then it's just all of the, you know, you've got the wardrobe department coming. I mean, Joel and Ethan said they wanted me to wear, I forget what that, you know, the kind of the fringe jacket that like Tonto wears, you know, whatever that's called, the buckskin coat or whatever. So that was their idea, you know. And then you go to the wardrobe fitting, you do the wig fitting, the mustache and everything, and you start to put the guy together. And, you know, it's fun. And also it's very liberating when you get to do that. Again, you have to be realistic. Like, I feel like he's realistic. I feel it. You know, yeah. It's a little over the top, but in a way that's believable. You believe that this guy is, you know, he's full of himself, but he's a human being that you're allowed to laugh at.
Well, it's interesting how everything he does, and this is, I think, what the disappearing part is, or the magic trick is every decision that LaBeouf makes. Based upon the lines, it all emanates from one essential core of who he is. Like, it's not, oh, that line's good, I can do that this way. There's a plan that,
yes.
I think about the eye, the shooting thing.
That's my favorite bit. It just happened, we'd shot it a bunch of times, and it's just the, like, you know, the self, the satisfaction that he takes, and he's like, you know, I thought you were going to say the sun was in your eyes. That is to say, your eye. And he, like, turns away. Like, and I don't know, I just did it one time, and I almost fell off the horse because I was laughing so hard, because it was just kind of perfect for that guy.
But I wonder if you've gotten so sort of good at creating characters and finding that core of a character that maybe you don't even know how you do it anymore, but... I think he said that joke exactly how he could only say that joke, right? And it just, I guess I wonder what that, how you get to that point where you can just say something, you know, off the cuff and have it be completely in character.
But it's also just being with great directors, and if you trust who you're working with, you can push it, you know, and they'll reel you in. They'll say, no, that's too much. You know, you're in the wrong movie. I mean, Steven, one of my favorite notes I've ever got from a director was when we were doing The Informant, and there was a scene where my character is in a courtroom and the whole town has shown up, and he apologizes. And we had the transcript of what he said. And we go to shoot it, and I say verbatim what Mark Whitaker said. And it's, you know, he's apologizing for what he's done and for the people that he's hurt. And the first take, I did it, and, you know, I this emotion kind of welled up in me. Like, I felt this guilt and this shame, and it was real. And Steven was on, it was kind of a wide shot, and Steven was probably 20 feet away. And he comes out from behind the camera and walks over and goes, no. And I go, fuck you, no. I was like, that was real. I was like, it had to go down something like that. Like, we had the transcript, you know. And he goes, no. I go, it was authentic. What just happened, it was authentic. He goes, no, you're just in the wrong movie. And I said, okay, put me in the right movie. And he puts his head down and he thinks, and he goes, do it like an awards acceptance speech. And he turns around and walks away. And it was the greatest, because it was like, of course, this is this guy's moment. Like, everybody's come out to see him. Like, you know, this is it. Like, this is a good thing. I had been, you know, putting my own judgment on, like, but, you know, Matt's judgment on, but, like, for Mark, this is like,
wow.
You know, and it was, and that's like what, that's great directing. That's the thing that, like, gives me pause. I mean, you know, is that there is a right thing to say, and it is simple. Because if you talk too much, it's just clutters an actor. You need to be, do it faster, do it slower, you know, right. Do it here. You know, you need to be kind of course corrected and put in the right movie sometimes, but the wisdom and the precision that he had, like, and it made me laugh, and I knew exactly, you know, there was so much information contained in that note.
Yeah.
I think we probably did one take. We might have done an extra take just because we were having fun, but it was, you know, and the scene really works. If you have a deep understanding of the story you're telling, you know, then he'd never thought of that concept of an awards acceptance speech, but he knew exactly what that scene was. You know, Spielberg, when we did Saving Private Ryan, I remember my, like, second day of shooting with him, I asked him where the storyboards were. And he goes, storyboards? I go, come on. He goes, I don't have any storyboards. And I looked at him, and he goes, that's the rush.
What you describe, I hear you saying that sometimes the answer, the perfect answer, is right in front of you, but it kind of takes being there and being in the moment, you know, to find it, right?
Yeah, and it takes a director who, it takes a great director.
Right.
Because a great director who's not afraid to go in not having the answer, you know what I mean? And finding it in that moment, which is like that ER story from Contagion, and it's other scenes I've done with Paul. It's finding it, you know, having the faith that you're going to find it.
Right, and the trust that...
Right.
Right. Now, you've worked with some of the most amazing directors of all time. I mean, there's a partial list here. Martin Scorsese, Coen Brothers, Steven Spielberg, Clint Eastwood, Steven Soderbergh, of course, Francis Ford Coppola, Gus Van Sant, Anthony Minghella, Christopher Nolan, Robert Redford, Paul Greengrass, Terry Gilliam, Cameron Crowe. I mean, it's insane, this list of people you've gotten to work with. And you told me once that it was almost like a career choice for you to go down the list of your favorite directors and make sure you worked with all of them. It's almost like, you know, who gets the opportunity to do that? Who gets the opportunity to make those choices unless, you know, you've had this incredible amount of success? And I look at that choice as such a smart one because, you know, our time and our choices are limited. And you know, you made this conscious decision to not stay in some comfort zone, but to really go after interesting projects based on the people who were helming them.
Right.
When did that idea come up for you?
Well, I never wanted to be the, you know, somebody who kept repeating himself. Like, I would talk to actors early on in my career who were like, yeah, I'm going to work again. And they were so bummed out about it because they were being asked to do the same thing over and over again. And so I just never wanted to have that. I never wanted to be in that position where I was just repeating you know, just playing the same guy over and over and over again. I think I'm a much better actor now because I've taken that tack,
right.
You know, and done different stuff with different directors and kind of been forced out of my comfort zone a little more, maybe.
Well, I wonder if that is, at this point, the only way left to challenge yourself. Because you seem like a guy that is going to always want to find the challenge and find the new experience in something. And, you know, it must get harder to challenge yourself, you know, in terms of new kinds of roles to play or, obviously it's not getting the job away from the other actor. So it really becomes about choices for you. And I wonder if part of that is seeking out these new and different directors that, you know, that you haven't worked with before. If that's part of you making it interesting and keeping your goals.
That's
going.
Part of the fun of like of actually work. I mean, working with Chris Nolan, even for on a small part, and his new movie was great. I mean, I had a blast. And when you, it's fun to find someone new that you just love and whose movies you love, and you know, and have that working experience. You know, I would be happy though if I could just work with the people that I've already worked with. You know?
Sure.
If I could just keep, you know, it's great to go back. You know, when you have something good with somebody, it's great to go keep working with them because the trust is just there, and so everybody can push themselves more because everyone's looking out for each other. So I think for me the big challenge is directing someday. You know, and that's what I really want to do and. I feel like I should be good at it, given who I've had access to, and you know, it doesn't mean I will be, but I know so much about it now.
Yeah, it's like you went to school. You went to a massive master class in directing, but it's got to be intimidating too, because you're not coming up with your peers directing. You're just watching people at the height of their game, and many of these guys, you know. We're doing it for 30 years before you met them, right?
Yeah. But they're all very willing to talk about, you know, how they do what they do. And Anthony said to me really early on, you know, he had just won all these Oscars for The English Patient, and I was meeting him for Ripley. And he asked me what it was like to work with Coppola. He was asking me about Spielberg, and he was asking me about Gus Van Sant. And I was like, you just won 43 Academy Awards. Like, you're asking, it's like 27-year-old guy about these directors. What do you need to know about directing? And he said, no, you don't understand. We all live on an island. He goes, and it's why actors make good directors. You get to visit all these islands, and you get to see. He goes, I have no idea how Steven does what he does, and I have no idea how Francis does what he does. And you know, you get to see that stuff, and I don't. And you get to take whatever you think works and build your own process around, you know, what you've seen work. And so I have all of this anecdotal knowledge of, you know, there's not a situation probably that I haven't been in on a movie set.
Sure.
And I've watched all these guys kind of think their way out of all these, you know, problems. It's all problem solving, right? So I've watched all these creative problem solvers kind of work their way out of these jams that they get into, and so theoretically I should be able to do it.
What is standing in your way right now from doing it?
It's just logistics. I had a project that I really liked, but I had to give it up because it just I couldn't with my family. I got to find something where I can take the kids and where it's just a tough. It's a much more labor intensive. You know, there's a huge part of my job that I can do now at home, and I'm really only working when I'm in production. And you know, when you're directing, it's this lengthy pre-production, and then post-production. You know, the post is fine because you can do that and live at home.
But, sure.
The pre-production, you're gonna be on location, and so as an actor, I can take a job and go, and either take the family or do it over a summer so that the family can come. But as a director, that's harder to do. So I'm gonna have to find something that somehow can work with my life.
Do you feel a responsibility at this stage when you take on a film and you're the junior partner with the director and it's a big film financially and everything? Do you take that pressure on of how the film's going to do at the box office, or how the do you take that on, or is there some Zen thing of this is out of my control?
Well, I mean, I don't think about that while I'm shooting as much as, because you're just trying to make the very best movie that you can.
Right.
You know, presumably you've entered into it, everybody's gone in with their eyes open. We've all decided, you know, the studio, the director, and, you know, we've all decided what we're going to try to make. And then it's like all of your energy goes into trying to make that thing so that you deliver on the promise to each other, right? And then, yeah, if you've made a great movie and it doesn't, I always think of like Out of Sight, you know, the movie that Steven did with George, which is just fantastic. It's a phenomenal movie. And it didn't do well.
Right.
You know, and it's like, I'll take that one. You know, I'll take Out of Sight and you know, let it be a bomb when it comes out or whatever. You know, that movie 20 years later is still brilliant. And,
sure.
And so, and I think, you know, with, if I was running a studio, I would just invest in directors, basically, that I believed in, whose movies I liked. And over time, you're going to win because you're investing in that library. So if you invested in Steven Soderbergh 20 years ago, yeah, Out of Sight was a brilliant movie that didn't do well at the box office. He's had a bunch of little experimental films that, you know, may or may not have paid back the $1 million they cost to make, but he had the Oceans franchise, and he had Traffic, and Aaron Brockovich,
sure.
And all these movies, Contagion, all these big hit movies, and, you know, that were actually good, too, and so yeah, I mean, I think there is part of you that gets a little zen about it, because you go, my job really is to make the best movie I can.
Right. Well, it makes me wonder if, you know, what the most, I guess, enjoyable part is for you now. Is it being involved in the story, or is it the craft of your acting?
I think, like, going forward, it'll be, if I'm not directing the movie, it'll be about who I'm working with and the character. And is there something, you know, really, you know, different and exciting? And, you know, that problem-solving part of it is really fun. And when you feel like you've done a scene, and every element has worked exactly the way the whole team has kind of, you know, that you've pulled the magic trick off together perfectly. Like, those are the scenes, you know, that are memorable for me. You know, completely believable. You haven't seen it before. You know, there's something unexpected. There's, you know what I mean? Like, all of these little things kind of come together, and you get a great scene. And that's when it makes you jump out of bed in the morning.
Right. It's funny, when you were coming here and I was preparing for this, I really wanted to talk about character building and believability. And as we're speaking, what I'm hearing is that so much of that is a collaboration process with the director and the script and the movie and what's happening on the day and how you fix something. And, you know, one of my questions was going to be, you know, how much can you save from your prep and how much do you throw away? But it seems more like the conversation is about the bigger picture always, and then the smaller stuff falls into place.
Yeah, your prep is your prep, and you have to do, like, that's all personal, and there's a lot of stuff that doesn't end up being useful. So you know, I think I heard Anthony Hopkins say once in an interview that the older you get, you know, and the more kind of technique that you have, the more economic your process becomes. So, you know, when you're young, you know, I mean, shit, I moved to Knoxville, Tennessee, and tended bar for a month to get the accent for The Rainmaker. And, you know, and that's great. And that worked, you know, but I ain't doing that now. You know what I mean? And the key is to make sure that you could do it without the performance suffering at all. You know, there are times when I've just done stupid shit. Like, I don't know, you know, sleeping with a football for a movie once. I held the football. It was just like, why? You know, I was 20 years old. Like, it just absolutely pointless exercise. You know what I mean? But I just was trying to find every. I wanted to turn over every stone. You know, and I think when you know, the more you do it, the more you know what you don't have to do.
Right. Do you think actors are on an island? Like you mentioned, directors are on an island. Like, do you ever wonder what other actors are doing prepping for a script and how they do it? And like, did you wonder about that for a while? Like, is there something I'm not doing here that will help me crack this character?
I always wondered about Brando. That was really the one that you know.
Oh, really?
And because there was such a mystique about him, but and because of what he did, that was just, you know, it's just really the gold standard of, you know, there's really only one, and it was him, for my money. But yeah, I mean, I've read a lot of books about other actors over through the ages, and what, and heard stories about how they prepared, and but you know, not so much of the people that are working today. It's more like Brando and Hackman, and you know, back in those times, and then you know, and I've worked with a lot of the, you know, I got to work with De Niro and you know, talk to him about a lot of this stuff, and you know, people are very. They're very helpful. They're very, you know, they want, you know, you can engage them in those conversations when you're working together. And I've always been kind of curious in that way. So I've picked up a lot that way.
Are there times when you're working with another actor and they kind of blow you away with something and it reinvigorates your craft or something? Like, do you remember a time recently when you were working with somebody else and just felt like, you know, wow, that's...
Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, working with Cate Blanchett again on Monuments Men, and just, you know, she's this wonderful, lovely Australian woman, and I worked with her on Ripley a long time ago, and then they say action, and suddenly there's this French lady there. It's literally like her energy, the actual energy, like the pheromones or whatever is coming off her, is different, completely different. And
you don't see her trick. It's just magic.
It's just magic. It's actual magic. Yes. Yeah. That's and I've always felt that way about her. Like, she's somebody who I do watch.
Right.
Carefully.
Right. Do you feel like you change your performance also once you see what the other person's doing?
Well, I've always felt like if there are actors who are so good that they're good enough for both of you, and like you're just riding, you know what I mean? You're just they're so good that they just take you right into it, and you know, and then gently put you down at the end of the scene.
Well, people would argue that you're one of those people too.
Those people are drunk.
Well, you're far too modest to you know, to talk about you that way, but I will. I find your work. I find you're a disappearing act, and the ability for you to be a completely different person every time you do a film, amazing. And you know, I think about something we talked about a few years ago. We were having some beers, and we were talking about our kids, and I said, like, how do you know, knowing that you're doing well and you're making money, how do you make the decision to go off and work when you don't need to? Necessarily. And you said something that was, I thought, really, really mature and really inspiring to me. And actually, it stuck with me ever since you said it. You said, I want my kids to see me doing the thing that I love to do and I do best. And if I don't do that, what kind of example am I setting? And that stuck with me the whole time. You know what I mean? And I guess just to finish, I would just, you know, love to know if that's still kind of your guiding philosophy.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I was raised by, you know, by a mother who eventually became a professor, but who never made a lot of money, but loved what she did. And a father who did what he had to do to make money, but didn't love what he did. And both of them, you know, they were divorced, but they both independently gave my brother and I the same message, which was, whatever it is, just follow what you want to do. That's where you will find true happiness. And that was true for both of us. And I think about that with my kids. I want them to see that their father loves work, and that you can love your job, and that it can be a big part of who you are, and it can nourish your soul. You know, work doesn't have to be a four-letter word. And so, yeah, I hope that I never wind up on another movie again that feels like work. Every once in a while, you do.
Sure.
Try as you might not to, but I want them to see that creating something can be just a source of such joy. And because they can read you perfectly. So when you're feeling that joy and living in that joy, they can see it and they can feel it and they know what it is.
And then they get infected by it.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing this. And it's just, you know, it's fun to stop and sort of dig into things that we wouldn't normally talk about. And, you know, just it's very generous of you to come and share that
And we
stuff.
Didn't even need the beer. We just did it with water this
I
time.
I know. Well, actually, I forgot about the beer. I did promise that, didn't I?
I have to drive anyway.
So. Thank you.
Thanks, man. It was great.
You have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.